The House by the Bilvano Colzo by Steve Rasnick, Tim. Copyright 2007, Steve Rasnick, Tim. Read by the author. Violins provided by eFiddler.com. The dead speak softly, but their words insist, infection in a nacking wound. Mikhail could hear their voices beneath the rumble of traffic along the boulevard, and even through the clamor of the 10 lanes of the Garden Ring. Not everyone was equipped to discern their particular range, the murmurings of those long-dead lips beginning so subtly as if an aspect of the ambient sound, like the violins in a movement out of Shostakovich, gradually swelling until the entire orchestra is involved, and every footstep, every automobile, every pneumatic hammer pounding the weary heart of Moscow echoes those futile but incessant words of the dead. These dead, his dead, were long buried, their mouths and throats full of rubble, and still they would not be silenced. But what exactly they were saying, he could not have told you. In the old days, his mother once told him, the peasants sat watch by a covered body until it could be moved. It was not a pleasant task, Mishka, but it had to be done. They did this out of respect, but also out of fear. The dead demand the appropriate rituals and are quick to take offense. At the time she spoke these words, she'd had no idea how many dead there would be. She had never possessed the kind of imagination required to visualize a landscape contoured in corpses. Not just in the countryside with the famine or in Leningrad, where they ate their shoes and then each other, but in her beloved Moscow as well, where in 1937 the party would shoot almost 2,000 of its citizens a day. Today Mikhail had come directly from the train station, trying not to look too closely at any of the passing faces for fear of what he might see. Once he had sworn he would never return here, but he had known eventually that he would have to see. He would have to look. He stepped back into the street, his tired eyes taking measure of its flaking structure, the exterior walls plastered and painted to hide the house's pre-revolutionary glamour. Now the building underneath was shedding these layers. Bits were falling into the street, and a fence had been erected to contain the piles of epidermal debris. He would not have recognized his childhood home if not for the clear image locked in his mind for decades, which he could now superimpose over the shambles. Even with failing eyesight, he could see the missing balconies, the ornate scrollwork, and the once delicate pilasters. His mother had always wanted to live in a grand house on a quiet street close to the centers of power. For her, becoming a Bolshevik had simply meant she did not have to be a peasant anymore. "You are a foolish woman, Atsela. Someday your stupid dreams will get us shot." Gleb de Sol, from behind him, bread and salt. Mikhail turned. An old woman stood beside a shrouded form, silently wailing. She had no teeth, and her fingers rubbed so rapidly against each other, it appeared she held a fluttering bird. A bony hand squeezed his heart, but he stumbled across the street in her direction. "Who is it?" His eyes streamed. Now the old woman's toothless mouth parodied a smile. She rearranged the white sheet lovingly around her loaves of bread and gestured. When he didn't respond, she wrapped a loaf in a scarf and stuck it into his arms. Mikhail could not find a mouth in the weathered brown skin. Perhaps it had sealed over from disuse. I cannot eat this. Kleb the soul. The words were barely discernible inside her mangled mouth. It was a welcome to the neighborhood, but he was not new here. He wanted to explain. He wanted to explain everything, but now she gazed at her baked children as if dismissing him. I cannot eat this. But he slipped it into his backpack rather than drop it into the road. It continued to make faint, distressed infant noises with its no-mouth. In Leningrad, during the war, some children became so sick they could no longer open their mouths. Then it was over for them. The rusty fence surrounding the house sagged almost to the pavement in spots. According to Koslov, the house would be razed within a fortnight. He had paid Koslov and his criminal partners most of his savings to stay here until then. But Mikhail did not resent the price, for his true debt was massive. His house by the Boulevard Nikoltso soared almost as high as he remembered. A short level tucked under the roof, then four floors with ceilings at almost 4 meters unless they'd been inconsiderately lowered to save on heat. There was no elevator, and the steep stairs contributed to that sense of looming, overreaching size. But this wreckage, curling away from the underlying brick, did not resemble his mother's fine house at all. This had never truly been their home. It had been the property of some wealthy Muscovite family before the revolution, and the government had permitted them to stay here in consideration of his father's role. They had had everything for a time when so many had had less than nothing. Mikhail should have refused to live here. And what do you hope to find? He turned around. The woman was gone. His father had been unpleasant, paranoid, an angry man who some people said was handsome. His dark, suspicious eyes recalled Stalin's, the hero who is not such a hero, as Mikhail's mother had put it foolishly. Even at 10 years he had been aware that she should keep her mouth shut. He had noticed now and then that an apartment or a house suddenly became vacant. Classmates would miss a day of school, then two, and then he would never see them again. He understood that if his mother did not shut up, the three of them would end up covered in sheets, watched over by some poor peasant woman with saucer eyes. Beria, his father's boss at the KGB, would see to that. We are Stalin's kittens now, Mikhail, his father always said. Shadows flowed across the house as several black, official-looking cars eased along the street before turning at the next corner. A back window rolled down a few centimeters as the car passed him. In the surrounding houses, here and there a figure in a window silhouetted against a curtain. Many of the buildings here were of that Stalin-era architecture, straight up and down with little ornamentation, their sharp angles and great coloration like statues of Stalin torn down after his death. Suddenly anxious to get inside, Mikhail stepped too quickly, the arch of his foot turning over on a piece of brick, taking him down. People surrounded the house, trying to get in. There had been rallies all around here, marches of the people. History had changed. What was he doing here? Foolish as his mother, he had put himself into danger once again. The day had finally come when it no longer mattered who his father had been. Playing outside the study, he'd listened to his parents argue again, then the slap, "Slut! Fool! Do you know what Beria does with his women after he is finished with them? Do you know what he does to their families? Within the week, his mother and then his father had disappeared, and Mikhail had been sent to live in one of the orphanages for children of enemies of the state. He remembered little of that particular ride. Mikhail pulled himself up out of the street. There was no crowd, but the darkness felt close and full of awful potential. He was aware of the bread woman watching him as he picked up his lantern and battered suitcase and stepped onto one edge of the collapsed fenced wall, forcing it down. It sprang back half-heartedly as he stepped off. He heard the woman's brittle laugh, and he turned to stare, turning back just as quickly when he saw that her face had again lapsed into a silent scream. The key Kozlov had given him was of no use. The door edge was splintered, the top hinge broken, the entire assembly leaning away from the frame, making a narrow gap. A vague trace of semicircular scrape trailed away from the heavy door toward the quiet street. Leaves and dirt caked the step several centimeters above the bottom edge of the door, spilling through the gap and into the sliver of interior he could barely see. He was days away from his 80th birthday. If the door fell, he would not have the strength to wrestle it into place again, and then this tortured mouth of the house would hang open, its teeth broken, and Mikhail knew from experience the temptation to kick the injured. In the orphanage, the children's heads had been shaved, and they had slept five or more to a bed. Mikhail remembered kicking a smaller boy out of the bed. You did not survive without a bit of kicking. The boy had sat on the floor holding onto one leg of the bed, crying without sound. To make a sound would be to invite more kicking. Mikhail had got out of bed, kicked the boy again, and got back under the thin blanket. The other boys smelled, but they at least kept him a little warm. During breakfast the next morning, he'd stared at the boy, and the boy had kept his distance after that. Then Mikhail hadn't seen him anymore. Now, sometimes Mikhail fantasized that the boy had survived. They met again as old men and become friends, companions reminiscing about those terrible times. He walked to the corner of the house, careful of the jagged bits of dark metal curling up out of the debris piles, pieces of gate and balcony and window bar. Between their old mansion and the next, now converted to offices, was a space not as wide as he remembered, but perhaps wide enough. Mikhail discovered that although he couldn't walk comfortably between the houses, he could still slide through sideways with his lantern in his right hand, dragging the suitcase and backpack with his left. He found the narrow window almost halfway down. If Stalin had chased him, snorting toxic plumes of black smoke out his pipe, mechanical hands opening and closing, eager to tear out chunks of Mikhail's flesh, he would have run down into the cellar and out this Stalin door. His mother never expressed her opinion of Stalin directly, but if Mikhail were stubborn, she would say, "You're just like Stalin." Once when Mikhail had fallen in the street and scraped the side of his face, she had dragged him into the house, crying and frightened. When she finally saw that his injuries were superficial, she had told him, "Your face will be pockmarked like his. Be reasonable. Don't be like Stalin," Oksana had said to him 30 years later when he talked about someday reacquiring this grand piece of property. They had been living in France. Neither of them had been in Russia for decades. The glass of the Stalin door was already broken out. He tossed his things in, crouched, and pushed his feet inside, the legs falling after. He sat on the ground then, half in and half out of the house, using his hands to push himself in further where he began to wedge. He wiggled his hips, sucked in his belly, pushed harder, thinking, "At the end of my days, I return to my dirty beginnings." Stuck. Pushed more, and felt the window frame splinter, digging into his hips, but he kept pushing, scraping through cloth and scraping away skin as he forced the cellar to swallow him. There had always been boxes in this cellar, cases, crates, sealed bags of one sort or another. Mikhail had thought at first these must contain gifts from the relatives, items from their previous residences, perhaps an object or two from the original owners. Then one evening, it must have been close to the end of their time here, he had been playing at being a great hero and had fallen asleep, then awakened to see his father across the room moving containers. Several had been opened, their contents exposed, china and shiny metal, paintings, small statues, beautiful things like out of a museum. His father pulled out a small bronze horse and carefully laid it into a crate, hammered at the lid, resealing it. Then he sat back smoking a cigarette, looking around, and Mikhail had to shrink down again. The rest of that summer, Mikhail became a grave robber, a tomb raider, an adventurer, and a thief in the land of the dead. But he would not enter this room after dark, when the crates became coffins and the canvas bags the bodies after a mass shooting. Now the cellar possessed very little of interest, a few sticks of furniture, some dusty crates full of soil, an attitude of vague, dreamy recognition passed over him as he discerned a straight-backed chair that had sat outside his parents' bedroom. He would sit there sometimes, he remembered, waiting for an audience with them, and over there was a cracked bit of pottery painted with a rooster. It had been on one of the shelves in the kitchen and sometimes had held sweets. Upstairs, the rooms were almost entirely empty and confusing because he only remembered them furnished. Most of the oak trim had been stripped. The stairs were dark and smelled of past inhabitants. Some of the rooms nearer the roof had large windows with glass intact, allowing blasts of bright light that caused the walls to wither. Faded wallpapers torn into strips with crisped edges, plaster crumbling beneath furies of holes, carpets buried under tides of grit and splintered wood. One of these, he decided, had been his parents' bedroom. He set up camp there, spreading his things beside a cast-iron radiator, at some time in the past painted an unconvincing shade of gold. As light retreated from the windows, he imagined the radiator ticking, and that allowed him to imagine heat. The lantern cast the room into a yellow light escaped from remembered photographs. His grandparents, other peasant relatives he'd never met. His weak eyes functioned poorly under these conditions. There was still enough ambient light to make out some details, an arching doorway, a mangled wall sconce, tracks through the dust as if from raking fingers. Some walls appeared impossibly close, certain doors too far away. He felt trapped inside an amber bubble of memory, ringed by bystanders who edged away, showing him a shoe, a glimpse of Pat's leg. He could hear their shuffling feet. "What do you want here, Mishka? What do you hope to find?" Though his stomach groaned, he still could not bring himself to nibble on the woman's bread. Before retiring, he peered outside. She hunched over, mourning her dead beneath the sheet, her face turning up, empty mouth slowly collapsing. He slept in fits and starts, getting up now and then to search the house with his lantern. He would examine the same room 2-3 times. "Where are they, Mishka?" The stairwell was a vast dark shaft, many stories taller than it should have been. The treads were too shallow. He wondered if the edges had worn down over the years from so many feet. Here and there he could not see a step, even with the lantern, and put his foot down without conviction, almost surprised when it landed on something solid. The steps felt as if they were swaying, and that he was on a footbridge over a deep valley. He let the lantern draw him down, and when he finally did find the cellar, he had to sit down and weep for a time before he could make himself start up the stairs again. The next morning's light, brighter than he would have expected, did not benefit the appearance of the house. Everything was discolored, stained, peeled off, or broken apart. As the warmth increased, a blending of stenches issued from carpet, corners, and particular walls. Again, he felt compelled to look through the house, again finding no signs that the house had been lived in at any time during the last few years, and yet he had the impression of thousands. Around mid-morning, he'd had enough. A park ran along the traffic lanes with walks and benches where the old people sat, ponds and children's playgrounds. He had felt compelled to engage in such daily hours-long walks in every European city he and Oksana had made home, encountering many other expatriates, intently examining passing faces of a certain age. The day was foggy, and Mikhail's tattered sweater did little to keep out the cold. He could hear the traffic increasing in volume and complexity as the hours passed, but he could see only an occasional gleam of bumper or hubcap, the side of a panel truck, through the mist-furred trees. Their speeds seemed reckless. Vehicle exhaust had made a kind of sour soup of the fog, and it adhered to his skin. He really had no business being out in such air with his lungs. Already he was feeling a mild intoxication. He coughed. Someone else coughed. From a nearby bench stared an old man who could have been his brother. But Mikhail had no brothers. He walked closer. The old man did not drop his gaze. The gray eyes swam. "Kaku vas dela?" Mikhail asked. "How are you?" "Paratspa." "It is time to sleep." The floor of his childhood had been so hard last night, but to fall asleep in such air might be deadly. The old man stood up, reaching out as if to embrace him. "Yipir, vampire!" Mikhail shouted foolishly, stumbling down the lane. He'd simply been startled by the man, he thought, but unaccountably he had no better luck catching his reason than catching his breath. He continued to hurry away, running into things, his vision obscured. The old man's sobs chased him past more benches, coagulating out of the fog, all of them full of elderly clones, eyes beseeching, worm-like fingers undulating in distress. If they didn't get out of this fog, they'd all die. He slowed inevitably, pain in his knees. He did not know exactly where he was, could not think about it. Faces from his childhood rising like balloons severed from their owners, popping in the fog. He found himself by water for a time, the sound of unseen oars splashing. Then there was a playground, a small child swinging slowly at the end of gleaming chains. The fog had moved in close behind the child. Mikhail could see nothing past the playground. The child did not smile back. He wore a commissar's uniform. It was that bloody dwarf Yeshov, the chains wrapped around his neck. Good riddance to bad rubbish. But then the fog moved forward, sweeping over the swinging body of that murderer, resolving itself ever so slightly into human outline, rank after rank, strolling in his direction, a slow-motion march. Mikhail turned and was stumbling again, arthritic legs screaming, running through the poisoned air. The peasant sat on a small pile of broken brick. His cap was faded, caked in filth from wherever he'd been sleeping. His long, ragged beard made the lower part of his face appear to be in decay, bits of cheek and chin breaking away, dripping. Behind him, several bodies lay shrouded. The peasant did not look up at him, which was no small blessing. "Ja vishtu tebya voshne," the peasant said to the ground. "I see you in my dreams." By sunset, Mikhail had made it almost home, stopping to rest at Jervskaya Street, closed off that evening for some party or other. Once night began, the darkness fell swiftly. The peasants had lived in darkness for centuries, long enough, his father once told him, that the darkness had seeped into their souls. "Ja vishtya ridim," the peasant said behind him. "I am always next to you." There had been a great deal of clumsy drinking. Broken glass cracked underfoot. He heard French accents. "Tu dois s'imagrire." "You must be dreaming," the woman in front of him cackled, lowering her wine glass. Her lips appeared to adhere to the rim, pulling down into a distorted grin. A section of her gums and teeth were missing. "How many dead?" It sounded like an American in the crowd. You never saw them back when Mikhail was a child, but everyone knew their movies, westerns mostly, and Charlie Chaplin. Supposedly Stalin liked Charlie Chaplin and Spencer Tracy, especially in Boys Town. "Yevish pod kontrolom," everything is under control. "You there, old man." He was tall and broad-shouldered, but he was just a drunk boy. "Kato racha menya ibit." "Someone wants to kill me." "Laissez-moi." Without thinking, Mikhail had shouted it in French. "Leave me alone." But the boy just laughed, staggering as his friends dragged him away. All around Mikhail, the bodies bobbed up and down, dancing. The fog had reached even here. He could see it floating up around the revelers' legs, gathering at their waists. He wanted to warn them all not to breathe it in, but he could not make himself open his mouth. "Prenyasno," from behind him, "sweet dreams." He was so hungry when he reached the house by the Bavarnia, he knew it was not an ordinary hunger. He still had not eaten the bread the old woman had given him. He did not think he could. Certainly this was not the worst hunger he had ever experienced. He remembered little about the train trip to the orphanage, but he could remember the hunger. He had watched the other children, and they had watched him. A little girl had said she had a bit of cake her mother had given her, but it was so stale and hard because she kept it so long. Mikhail had not cried, preferring to eat his tears. In the orphanage, they'd had stew thin as water. Mikhail had walked bent over some days because of the belly pain. When he'd finally walked away from that place with three other boys, they had survived on roots, bark, and boiled shoes for over a week. By the time he arrived in France, his arms flapping against his sides had sounded like laundry in the wind, and he dreamed of food while also hating it. His body had eaten his spirit. After just a day, this had become almost like those hungers, a ghost of those hungers, a fierce animal that had crawled inside and was now eating its way out. Mikhail looked up and down the street for the woman with her bread. He could not let go of the idea that he wanted, craved bread, and could not go into that shipwrecked house until he had had some. But search as he might, he found no sign and returned to his house, walking over the remains of the fence. The door was open, pried off its broken jamb, and shifted to the side. A soft, not uninviting light burned through the opening. Inside he found Koslov and one of his henchmen, both of them looking like thick oil drums with hats, warming their stubby fingers over a fresh fire in the hibachi. "You leave the fire burning like this, Mikhail, you burn the place down. No good." "Does it matter? You said it was all to be demolished." "In its time, Mikhail. The people I work for, they worship their schedules. They are, how do you say it? Schedulers. I cannot make them so unhappy, which means you cannot make me so unhappy." "I apologize." Mikhail went to the staircase, paused. "Was there anything else?" "Yes," Koslov said, turning, a false sadness glued to his face. "You may stay here 2 more days. I am sorry." "I paid for 2 more weeks. Koslov shrugged. "Again, I am sorry. I apologize. But that was before this infraction. These are my instructions. If there had been a fire, some official comes by, embarrassing questions would be asked. My associates..." He glanced at the other man, who appeared to have been paying the conversation no attention at all, "are very shy." "And if I refuse to leave in 2 days? Koslov sighed. "I have always liked you, Mikhail. Remember, I knew you in the old days. We passed each other on the street. Your father sold wine. My father bought the wine. Once I dropped a book, you picked it up, but only after stepping on it first." Koslov chuckled. "So you have endured much, but so have all our generation. Come to the window, Mikhail. Look out. What do you see?" It seemed ridiculous to still call the opening Koslov was standing by a window. It had been boarded up numerous times, layers of wood accumulating into a kind of modernist sculpture mounted on the wall. Then, to provide light and air to some previous illegal tenant, a rough hole, half a meter square, had been cut into one corner. It was too high to show the street, but a view of Moscow's similarly layered skyline was possible. Mikhail peered up through the hole. "I see nothing, really. I see parts of buildings, many buildings, one after another." "That is what you see? I see headstones, Mikhail." for the thousands who had nothing else to mark their graves. 2 days were more than sufficient. During his years away, he'd had the notion he owed some act of contrition. Now that he was here, he had no plan, no clear idea of what he must do. He had been just a boy. He had accused no one, had sent no one to prison, had shot no one. He himself had lost everything. Now he searched without knowing what he was searching for, and all he found were the dead. It felt right that he should pay some penalty, simply for being alive. He sat in his parents' old bedroom, leaning against a wall that smelled so bad he imagined some animal must have crawled inside and died. With a long stick, he poked at things, bits of trash, piles of rubble, the edge of the rug. Now and then the corner of the rug would flip up and the shadows underneath would scatter and the smell became worse for a time. "You are hungry, Mikhail. Come, eat one of my children." The bread seller's face glowed in the dim light as she gestured over her bread. The brown loaves arranged in a row. On a nearby table, a candle burned inside a skull. Mikhail struggled to his feet. He was inside, and yet this place looked so much outside. There was the skull and the woman with her loaves, the smell of farm animals, a distant hill, a tree with things hanging down, sacks of food or bodies. A tall window, the moon fixed in one corner as if nailed through its heart. He could not get the stench of the moon's blood out of his nostrils. Mikhail stepped forward, then stopped. Between him and the old woman was a gate made out of bones, the hinges, skeletal hands, the supporting post, femurs out of a very tall man. "Come, Mishka, do not be afraid. You were always so very afraid." "I was," he admitted. "I was a coward, and I was weak. After my father and mother were gone, after my friends, I was simply glad they had not killed me." "God does not want you to be afraid, Mikhail." "And where was God before? I think he is like Stalin. He made Stalin in his own image." He could hear the tiny bones cracking under his rotting shoes. He hadn't even realized it until he looked down and saw his hands on the gleaming bones of the gate, pushing it aside. "That is fine, Mikhail. It will be all right. Come and eat my babies." But he could not, even with the creatures inside him gnawing their way out, making wounds in his flesh so that they might see. He could not. He would starve, but that was far better than being one of those always eating. He was suddenly aware that he was alone in the empty room before he collapsed into the rubble-strewn floor. Someone peeled back his eyes. From his vantage point, he could now see that there was much damage in the ceiling. Great stains like a spread of disease over fields of wheat, and holes that might have allowed a glimpse of heaven, but instead had permitted hell to sleep in. Someone had removed all the stars. Electric wires hung down from the night sky. The old woman's face floated into view. "Paraspa," she said. "I promise I will wait here with you. Here, by the side of the road. You will not be alone. Paraspa." sweet Mikhail, it is time to sleep, and pulled the sheet at once over him and over what remained of the world.